You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Welcome. My name is Lise Grande. I'm the head of the United States Institute of Peace. The Institute was created in 1984 by Congress. It has a mandate dedicated to helping prevent, mitigate, and resolve violent conflict abroad. We're a public nonpartisan institute. It is our great honor today to welcome His Excellency Denis Meliuska, Ukraine's Minister of Justice. We're here for an important discussion on the possibility of using the seized Russian assets to finance the reconstruction and the defense of Ukraine. And we're here to discuss the role that the United States can play on this issue. There's been a lot of discussion about the seized assets. The estimates are that as much as $280 billion of frozen Russian assets are sitting in Western banking systems. Almost everyone recognizes that Ukraine has the moral right to use these assets. But how they're used, for what purpose, reconstruction, defense, does remain the subject of considerable debate. There are, of course, serious risks that are involved in the use of these assets or in the direction of those assets. The Russian government could retaliate by seizing Western assets that are under Russian jurisdiction. If the assets were to be used, we could see a withdrawal of other foreign sovereign wealth assets from the US and European banking system. These are some of the concerns. However, with European financial assistance to Ukraine faltering and US assistance currently on hold, this discussion is more important now and more timely now than it has ever been. We're so pleased that we have Ambassador David Sheffer, who will be moderating our conversation. We would like to welcome everyone to this, most particularly our friends from the Ukrainian Embassy. Excellency, it's a privilege to have you here.
Thank you.
Welcome to everyone to today's very, very important discussion about how to deal with this $286 billion estimated of frozen assets now of the Russian Federation in connection with the invasion of Ukraine and the consequences of it. Minister, I want to start by asking you briefly, of course. You live in the middle of a war right now in Kyiv, and also you have an interesting personal background that you bring to this mission at the Minister of Justice. Could you just introduce yourself for a few moments in terms of how you arrived at your position in the Ministry of Justice and what it's like to work in a war zone in a bureaucratic institution like the Ministry of Justice within the Ukrainian government?
Yeah, good question. I really hope we are not in the middle of the war, but somewhere close to the end. But with regards to how I became a minister, my kids still believe it was a mistake on my part. Somehow, maybe I understood wrongly what is expected. Still, I was practicing lawyer, had private practice. At a certain point of time, I became consultant and then full-time employee of the World Bank Group. Initially, IFC, then there was created global practice where IFC and World Bank merged different initiatives. So I worked in Kyiv, based in Kyiv, but worked for the region, focusing mostly on investment climate reforms. So I spent some years advising Ukrainian government, so I knew all in and outs. Like networks matter. So when President Zelensky was elected, so his approach to creation of the government and actually to creation of a team was that he wanted a complete reshuffle so that new people could come who never worked previously like for the government or inside the parliament. So the approach was know a person who had an experience of being member of parliament before would be allowed to enter the list for Sluga Narodnyi Party. So that's why that created kind of good opportunity to join. So that's where I made that mistake. I was elected as a member of parliament, so I was included in the Sluga Narodu party list. Didn't do much work during the election campaign, since I helped office of the president and the president himself to start his work until the re-election and election campaign to the parliament. So I have been a member of parliament during one day. Managed to register about 50 laws, so everyone was voting. I was like running in and out, like registering draft laws we prepared beforehand. Then I joined the first cabinet where Goncharuk was a prime minister. After half year, when Goncharuk resigned, a new prime minister came. Again, I remained as a minister of justice, and still. It's 4 years and a half I'm the minister. So I'm not pretty new to the job, since I consulted quite a lot, but still it's like from inside, it's a completely different picture. Minister of Justice is huge. We had up to 50,000 employees. Now it's a bit less because it's not like a classical ministry. We are a bit different from the rest of the ministries, so that we take care about legal aid. All legal aid network is ours. Bailiff system is ours. Prison system is ours. Like quite a lot of activities inside Ukraine, it's formally it's a part of the ministry. So it's a tough job, but it became significantly more difficult during the war. We received different tasks to perform, like prisoners of war. We didn't have any regulations how to deal with them. We became the main agency responsible for Russian assets, both internally. So we are dealing with confiscation. There is a separate procedure of that, sanction. And also we have our primary goal outside the country is actually seizure of Russian assets outside the country, in foreign countries. And of course, the most attractive goal would be to get access to sovereign assets of Russian Federation, meaning reserves of the central bank. That's why I'm here.
Thank you so much. You obviously have not been a cloistered lawyer. You have been out and about, and that gives you an appreciation when you see the destruction of civilian property, in particular, and infrastructure in Ukraine. I think you have probably a good sense of what that means from your World Bank experience and other experiences. I want to jump immediately into one of the most topical issues today, and then we can sort of fall back on larger issues. But right now there's discussion about whether or not the frozen assets of Russia, which are not seized assets yet, but frozen assets, should be directed towards the defense needs of Ukraine at this very critical period in the war, or simply reserved for reconstruction efforts. Do you have a sense from Kyiv of whether you would entertain the idea of any funds going into defense needs from the Russian assets, or is the general attitude that it should all be reserved for reconstruction requirements?
Really good question. I was never asked about, but I have an answer to that. Initially, we thought that Russian assets shall be spent only on reconstruction. So be it during the war, we still spend some Russian assets seized on the territory of Ukraine. We spend them on reconstruction activities. And we hoped that we would be able to keep them and gradually, step by step, spend year after year to reconstruct what we have, given that the amount of damages as assessed by the World Bank is almost $500 billion dollars, that would mean that even if we confiscate everything, that would not be sufficient to cover everything. But at a certain point of time, quite recently, we realized that this was a good dream, but the reality is significantly more tough. And our assessment shows that in 2025, and even maybe by the end of 2024, we will not have sufficient funds to cover non-military needs. Why is that? Because all our taxpayers' money, everything we collect, is spent on the war effort. For technical reason that our international partners not always are able to help with military assistance. So it's easier for many countries to give us loans or grants on non-military purposes, and that's why we spend everything we have on the war efforts. So in terms of non-military expenditures, we have to rely on direct financial assistance or loans. And the appetite on the part of our partners to help us with that is decreasing with time. So now we realize that some part of Russian assets, probably we would like to have them as a financial assistance to the budget. It could be regarded as reparations till the budget really suffered because of the war. But still, that would be a necessity to us. We are not talking about spending to cover a budgetary gap, like the whole sum, the whole amount, but at least part of it could be saved for that purpose. With regards to the military purposes, it's even more pessimistic scenario, I would say. To a certain extent, that's not really fair, after all. We fight for all of us, for the world rule-based order, and everyone understands that we need to be assisted with those sort of money. And if we would accept and entertain the idea that Russian assets shall be sent also to cover military needs, then technically that would mean that we shall forget about proper reconstruction that would destroy our dreams. This is difficult. Of course, at a certain point of time, we could be in a position that, well, we do not have any choice and we need to spend that money also on military needs. But that would be the most pessimistic scenario I could ever imagine with regards to the sending money to Ukraine. But under necessity, if there would be no other sources, then we would have no choice and we would accept that as well, definitely.
And I might add that all of the plans which are on the table right now are to allocate this for reconstruction funds. No one's put any formal plan down whatsoever that would allocate it to defense. But I think the important point you just made was, yes, reconstruction, but also there might be some budgetary requirements, you know, for the basic services of government that
healthcare,
are becoming critical.
Yes, healthcare, welfare, salaries to like civil service or whatever, just to run the government. There are basic needs. Without them, our government and country will not be run smoothly as it is. And it's not only people who are fighting, we are fighting also, but on different fronts.
Now, you are moving around in the world, and I think it would be helpful for the audience to understand with respect to how to deal with the frozen assets. Could you just identify the key governments you're having to deal with? I assume it's the United States, it's Belgium, where Euroclear has you know, 200 billion of the 286 billion. But we also read of, obviously, the G7 governments being concerned as well. Which governments and entities, including the EU, do you directly have to deal with to address the treatment of the frozen assets?
You actually described everything correct. So, of course, we have to negotiate with US. Within EU, with the European Commission, but also with European heavyweights, Germany, France. You mentioned Belgium. Yes, they have. They actually sit on this pile of money because of the Euroclear headquartered in Brussels. So those are major counterparts. Broader, like, circle would be G7. Again, there are different approaches among G7 countries, but still, each and every country within that group is important to us. They are actually decision makers. We also asked by our colleagues and partners to talk more intensively to Global South. Of course, Global South is not like a decision maker. There are no Russian sovereign assets there, but our partners, and we believe as well, that there should not be a line drawn between like developed countries, G7, and the rest of the world, so that it would be beneficial to have everyone on board with the idea. Mm-hmm. And given the concerns which are raised, and during the opening remarks, they were clearly like stated, a couple of them, it is important to have an understanding between as many countries as possible that this is a right thing to do, and there would not be damaging consequences with regards to any other country then, except for Russia. So that is our message, and we try to address that by way of negotiations and explanations. And of course, we are lawyers, meaning me and my team, and from the legal perspective, we do not see any major problems in terms of confiscation. There is existing law allowing that, existing rules. In any case, if any country believes that existing framework is not sufficient for confiscation, we are open for a discussion what new framework or new regulation shall be adopted or treaties concluded. So again, that is a part of our broader efforts, but major focus is on G7, that's true.
You just opened up the issue I wanted to broaden. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions relating to it. The G7 came out a few weeks ago in February with a very strong statement of the obligation on the view of the G7 that Russia must pay reparations to Ukraine. So that was a very firm statement by the G7. They did not take the next step to say with unity that that can be achieved through the confiscation of the frozen assets, because there are different points of view mm-hmm. among the different governments of the G7. With the United States and Canada recently, and the United States quite recently, actually tipping its hat towards a right of confiscation for this purpose. But we still have France and Germany and the United Kingdom being on the fence as to how this can be accomplished under international law. So there's kind of a debate within the G7 on the end game. But interestingly, they arrived at a solid statement about the right of reparations last month. Can you give us sort of your perspective on, and it won't surprise anyone, I'm sure, but it would be good to hear it, Ukraine's position on the right of reparations from Russia, because that might be part of, you know, negotiation at some point with Russia as well. But also, are you trying to navigate, or how are you trying to navigate what remains kind of a policy difference, or at least not a clarified one yet, of between the G7 governments about how to actually seize the assets?
Mm-hmm. There are differences in views on how to do that. Different approaches are supported by different countries. The most advanced one is here in the US. There are a couple of bills aimed at confiscation. Repo bill, mm-hmm. name is known to many experts here. We do support that initiative. It's about complete confiscation, sending money to Ukrainian needs. quite a radical and justified approach, I would say, mm-hmm. based on the motion of countermeasures. In a nutshell, that would mean that there are affected countries affected by the war, not only Ukraine. Quite a lot of our neighbors and US as well has to spend money on refugees. Businesses, Western businesses are affected and had significant losses. There are some security expenditures necessary to be made. So given that those countries who keep Russian assets also struggled and were affected by the war, they could apply countermeasures, meaning to pause or lift entirely sovereign immunity of Russian Federation. So if Russia violates international law, then countermeasures could be applied by avoiding fulfillment of certain obligations with regards to Russia. So that argumentation allows lifting sovereign immunity and confiscation of sovereign assets and sending the money to Ukraine. The approach of European countries is significantly more moderate, so they are not ready to negotiate and discuss confiscation of the principal. They do support, at least it looks like that, confiscation of the profits obtained in a way or as a result of administration of sovereign assets. We are talking about three, maybe 5 billion per year. That approach is based on the assumption that those profits, windfall profits, are not the property of Russian Central Bank, and they could be distinguished from the principal amount, and they could be sent to Ukraine, but technically from that perspective, that money is not Russian. So based on that approach, they are developing a framework to allow that. Well, we are grateful for that as well. This is kind of really significant amount of money. But that approach differs significantly from the approach taken by the US. And recently there were some calls for a third way when Russian sovereign assets are used as a collateral. So there would be an issuance of Eurobonds by Ukraine or by other countries with or without a guarantee of third countries, and Russian assets would be used as a collateral against the payment. So technically it is a bit more difficult, but it is possible. With regards to the right to get reparations, I haven't met anyone challenging the statement that we have the right to get reparations. We all understand clearly that there is no way that Russia would pay those reparations voluntarily. I was a part of the team which tried to negotiate some sort of peace treaty, or how could you call it, at the beginning of the war in 2022, after the full-scale invasion. There was a short period of negotiations. Mm-hmm. And one of the major and crucial demands of the Russian delegation was that we sign a waiver and refuse to require any sort of reparations on compensations, and all our suits to international tribunals shall be withdrawn. So that was like the topic they were not willing to negotiate. That was one of their major demands. So we understand their position clearly. They will never agree to pay voluntarily payment of reparations until maybe the regime change. But in that case, we shall understand what will happen next after Putin. But clearly we need to think about like forceful mandatory mechanism for Russians to pay reparations, in addition to what will happen next. Since, as I already mentioned, we keep fighting, Russians keep destroying our country. The amount of damages already exceeds the amount of sovereign assets freezed in G7 countries and on the territory of our allies. So we would also need to think about other mechanisms, like, for instance, to impose a tax on Russian revenues from oil and gas or whatever other resources are available to fuel compensation fund. And we also, there is an, like, our initiative to establish a register for damages already done. So there is an international organization, Register of Damages for Ukraine, already created. It is developing a software to keep all the data about damages. Next step would be creation and negotiations and establishment of compensation commission and compensation fund. So that fund could be used as a tool to collect both sovereign assets and some proceeds taken away from Russia when it is allowed to trade commodities. So that's how we see it, and we really hope that we will get support and support will continue.
I'm going to turn to questions in just a moment, but one comment and then one final question from me, which is, I think it's important when you pointed out the third possibility, which is the frozen assets as collateral for what could be sovereign bonds, you know, perhaps backed up with guarantees from foreign, from governments. There's also another way in which those frozen assets could be regarded as collateral. A report out by the Canadian NGO World Refugee and Migration Council a few weeks ago points to the methodology whereby you can bring the private sector into an arrangement for social bonds, which has the frozen assets as a backup collateral ultimately, if necessary, but not necessarily. In other words, there's a scheme in, to work this so that you bring the private sector into the equation as well. But what I want to emphasize is that as long as those frozen assets are not seized and they just sit there as collateral, you do minimize the court challenges that Russia could raise because they're all under frozen status until that ultimate moment if they're possibly seized as collateral. And that's to your benefit. In other words, you delay court challenges that can complicate the situation for you. I have a last question, which is, it does appear as if what is happening with Ukraine and the frozen assets of Russia is, in a sense, creating a new type of deterrence in international affairs. In other words, a very strong message that if, as a nation, you commit the worst of crimes, which is massive aggression resulting in massive atrocity crimes, everything comes together and you're responsible for it, then there's an opening in international practice and, I think, through precedent international law, that, yeah, there's a deterrent that is justifiable, which is if you've got you've got assets overseas, they can be frozen and ultimately confiscated for the worst type of behavior we can imagine on the part of a nation state. And while I've sort of done a little editorializing there, Minister, is that a general attitude as that you're looking at it as well, that this is a deterrent principle that you're developing?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to mention and explain these are assets of a sovereign central bank, so they are not protected by private property rules or private protection or whatever you can call under major conventions, European conventions or like global conventions. So whenever anyone is saying that, well, protection of the property is not allowing us to move forward, this is not true. We are talking about sovereign money. And risks for litigation are quite limited and low since there is no forum where Russia could come and claim and get any meaningful result. So their ability to litigate is close to zero. as our ability as well. So we cannot get any forum to and to resolve that sort of dispute and award a significant amount of payments which could be enforced anywhere. So, but let's put that aside. Deterrent. You are right. At the beginning, we were not that ambitious, you know, to introduce a new deterrent into the global security framework we have in the world. But still, this is a good argument. We used it. What I would say, it's even a bit more than that. We see it is from also different perspective. We had that period in time when the banking system was cleaned from dirty money, from the money of unknown origin, when like mafia or other like corrupted officials were refused to get access to the banking system, where financial monitoring was introduced, and it was painful for like businesses, like commercial banks lost quite a lot of clients. But ultimately, it was beneficial to them. So whenever you would say, like, let's imagine the world when financial monitoring does not exist, whether banks would be able to return back to like operating with mafia, never. Same here. So it's gonna be a bit painful to lose Russia as a client in terms of administrating funds. But ultimately, it's going to be beneficial to everyone. To those who administer funds, they would be more safely put in the system. There would not be political pressure, disputes. They would remain under radar. Now, who knew in Ukraine about Euroclear? Our in general audience, no one knew the name. Now it's everywhere. And I'm not really sure they are happy about that. So it's good for business to remain under the radars, and it's good for business not to deal with some problematic clients, I would say, and ultimately we all will benefit. And that indeed would create a deterrent. We would like to emphasize and ask our partners to make that deterrent not really broad enough, not to scare everyone out, so that it is not applied back and forth here and there. Otherwise, like the reliability of keeping sovereign assets safe would be decreased to a minimal level when nobody would be sure what to do and where to keep money, and everyone could end up like everyone would invest in gold and had some sellers full with gold, and that would be a huge blow to financial system. But to limit it to outright aggression when the border is changed by force, which happened in case of the war launched by Russia, when we have almost unanimous support worldwide, everyone understands and agrees that there was a grab of territory and the value of territorial integrity is understood by everyone. In that narrow case, when everything is black and white, to ensure a proper deterrence as a possible consequence under that sort of scenario, that would be great. This is kind of maximum goal we could set, but there are others, more negative scenarios. Just imagine the world where the money is not confiscated, and when the world starts negotiations with Russia agreeing to refuse like the rights of Ukraine to certain territories. What the message that would be? That would be not a deterrent, but incentive for others to use the force. So the risks here are not that we will create additional deterrent from violation of international law, but we actually could fail to keep existing deterrents already put in place throughout our history, and it will disappear. And one could only imagine what will happen next if each and every like totalitarian country would decide that this is kind of profitable, we could move forward. And if we took like only mathematics into account, Russia wouldn't lose anything. Okay, quite a lot of hundreds of thousands of their people or soldiers are dead, but mathematically they obtained more people than they lost by occupying our territories. So some assets are lost, but they received much more significant assets as a way of occupation. They received a control over the biggest nuclear power station in Europe by way of occupation. This is profitable business, and one should calculate what is more profitable or what is more risky, to lose sovereign assets or to grab a territory with all factories, people, industry base. And even from the military perspective, who would say that there would no be a chance or that Russia would not try to launch a conscription and mobilize all the people to their army and would attack another country by using Ukrainian people and instead. So that could happen. We have quite a lot of prisoners of war. I met them personally, who are Ukrainian citizens forced to enter Russian army, and they immediately preferred to became prisoners of war when they had opportunity, but many of them didn't have such opportunity. They were afraid. So again, from that perspective, if we use simple mathematics, that would show that even to keep some minor negative consequences for Russia would be difficult, not to say of introduction of new type of deterrence for such types of behavior. So we are in much more dangerous situation right now. I'm not really sure everyone understand that or cares about that, at least in the short period of time, but longer consequences are really terrifying.
Well, on that note, I want to open it up for questions. And yes, ma'am. We've got the mic coming around. Yeah.
Minister, thank you so very much for being here today and shedding such important light on this critical issue. I'm Dr. Elaine Sereo. I am the associate rector of a Ukrainian university. And my question is, can you see how possibly the frozen funds could be used as a leveraging factor in peace negotiations with Ukraine? You've already touched on their control of property and people and like the power plant and so forth. And would you address that if you can? Thank you.
Using sovereign funds as a leverage during peace negotiations is a negative scenario for us.
Okay.
That would mean that Russia still has a stronger line, a stronger position in negotiation. That would mean that we would need to surrender certain our ideas and certain position. That would mean that we are weak at the negotiation table. And I really wouldn't like to have that sort of scenario. So if we start imagining what type of negative scenarios could exist, that would be really nightmaric activity, and I would rather avoid that. So anything could happen. So we cannot exclude even the opportunity that we would lose the war entirely if we are not supplied with military or financial assistance, and there would be no reason to negotiate. Putin will occupy the whole territory of the country and he will not care about anything. And in comparison to what they got and what they received as revenues from oil and gas supplies they make, the revenues from the commodity they sell is pretty much significant to the extent they could allow themselves to forget about sovereign assets. That's why I do not see that they are aggressive to the maximum point possible when they hear about confiscation. probably inside their minds, they already forgot about those assets. They would try to use that as a leverage, no doubt with that. But this is not something substantial which could put Putin into some limits and make him behave. I do not expect that. So let's better forget about sovereign assets as a possible leverage. It won't be useful. Other tools are much better. We cannot exclude negotiations. That could happen. But it would be better to have strong Ukraine at the negotiation table, not a weak one. Otherwise, consequences would be terrifying to the same extent as complete failure and loss of the war.
I'll take the blue in the back and then up front.
Hello, I have two quick questions. One is the money, is it all Russian government money or is it private money from Russian oligarchs? Forgive my naivete. And my second question is, what's the UK's role in all this? Because obviously for years there was a lot of Russian money floating around the UK, and there was even a report on the British news last night about Russian cars or British cars that were still getting into Russia through Azerbaijan. So I'd just be curious to know what mm-hmm. the minister's opinion on those two questions are. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks. We are looking mainly on sovereign assets, meaning assets of the sovereign state. At what I said today is only about sovereign assets of the state. I'm not talking here at all about private money, since it's much more difficult to get that. They are protected. This is a private property, and they could be confiscated under pretty much unique circumstances, like avoiding of sanctions, etc. And the amount of money which could be confiscated from Russian oligarchs is pretty much limited. So we are talking about more or less simple exercise. Took a big chunk of money from one owner state, and the money which is not protected by any sort of history or Magna Carta in UK or whatever. This is sovereign money when there is no forum for litigation and no protection attached. So whenever I hear about the difficulties of taking away money of oligarchs, I agree with that. There are centuries long tradition of protection of private property, and it would be a civilizational U-turn on the part of our partners to agree on simple confiscation simply because the owners are Russian citizens who behave badly. We understand that, and we do not ask for that, at least in the shorter run. But in the longer run, this is also an opportunity particularly to focus on SOEs, stand-owned enterprises. And UK is a good supporter of us, not the most advanced one, but not the most skeptical of our allies, somewhere in the middle, and I would even say closer to the champions of confiscation. So we really will talk to them. They are members of G7, they are an important country, with the views, and recently they announced their views that they could consider mechanism where Russian assets are used as a collateral. So good partners of ours, closer to optimistic level, more radical one, and we are really glad of negotiating with them and close to the results. But they do not have much sovereign assets at all. Belgium is the most important one.
And if we could have your name, which I forgot on the last one.
My name is Lucien Basha. I'm the rapporteur of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe on the issue of seizure of Russian state assets. I was in New York on Friday with your deputy, Irina Mudra. We had a discussion with a number of representatives from the member states there discussing the correlation between the Council of Europe from my side and the United Nations, which paved the way through its resolutions of November and March 2022 and 2023. We are now at an advanced stage. In January, the Political Committee of the Parliamentary Assembly approved a draft resolution and recommendation for the creation of a mechanism adjacent to the Registry for Damages, which was created in May last year by the Council of Ministers, a mechanism that would be composed of two elements, a claims commission and an international trust fund, where the signatories would deposit the assets they have already frozen. To go back to what you said, the freezing of assets in itself is a countermeasure. Even the suspension of a sovereign right is a countermeasure. So it basically would mean going all the way with this countermeasure. It would not mean the introduction of a new countermeasure. So it would require political will, obviously,
yep.
By states that see the aggression for what it is, a violation of an erga omnes, of a peremptory norm of international law that affects all states. Would Ukraine support this mechanism? Would it be in line with your needs and with your vision as far as Russian state assets are concerned?
Definitely so. Sometimes I cannot distinguish parliamentary assembly from Ukrainian parliament. We are the same page to the extent, to the maximum possible extent. So thanks for that. And again, I really appreciate, we all really appreciate the support we have at the Parliamentary Assembly. And that is quite important to us. You perfectly described what we all intend to do and the mechanism we are trying to implement. The problem for me is that I have a feeling that I'm in sort of a bubble when everyone is friendly, everyone supports us. I'm still trying to find the opponents. Where are they? What are your arguments? And yeah, true, with regards to countermeasures, again, true. The only thing lacking is in our negotiations and on the part of our counterparts is the political will, true. So whenever there is a political will, there would be a way, and all concerns raised, they do not make me feel persuaded by that they are really justified. Let's take legal ones, countermeasures, obvious solutions to the problem, or solution to the problem. Reliability of euro or US dollar as a reserve currency. Well, pretty much weird arguments since other countries would not have much choice where to put their money. They would not go to China or India. If anyone wanted to do that, they already did. So they will keep their money in Europe, in the US, UK or Switzerland, and we all have major agreement how to move forward with that. So like to be afraid of money to escape G7 countries, no way. An argument that probably some confiscation will happen on the territory of Russia. Well, firstly, they already did what they want. They will continue that, whatever we do with Russian sovereign assets. And there are still plenty of state-owned enterprises, Russian state-owned enterprises operating on the territory of Europe and the US. So if they want to escalate, you could escalate, not even escalate, but to do the same what they will do, to compensate businesses who would have losses on the territory of Russian Federation. And probably those businesses would benefit from that, since now they are trying to move away from Russian market and they sell their assets for $1 or whatever. And in case confiscation happens on the part of Russia, they first would have a possibility to sue them, to start litigation on different venues, or to ask countermeasures on the part of Western governments and to be compensated by them. And there are quite rich SOEs operating here. So what else do we have? There are some like concerns with regards to history that whenever this happens to Russian assets and other countries would demand to be compensated for like different historical events. But those historical events is our past. We tend to forget about that. And if we are talking about some wars happened like decades ago, there is no ground to apply countermeasures. Since there is no war, you cannot apply countermeasures to the war which ended. So there is no danger with that as well. What else do we have? Concerning about litigation, there is no forum for litigation. Concern about military escalation, even Russians didn't threaten anyone that in case of confiscation they will do something bad. But that concern already outdated. Even the basic supply of the military equipment at certain point of time during the war was put on a pause because of that concern, but everyone forget about that. This is not serious. So what do you have? Actually, in a nutshell, there is no any valid argument why not to do that. It's just too many myths related to this confiscation, and probably lack of political will, and maybe the only valid argument, meaning that it's not could be outright put aside to use sovereign assets as a tool for negotiations. But I do not see any new prospect for negotiations in like nearest future without Ukraine as a strong force at the negotiation table. And to become strong at the negotiation table, you don't need to bring Russian assets at the table, but you need to bring some military might, be it Ukrainian or others. Doesn't really matter. So that's the major point. Putin understands only force due to his background. He doesn't understand law, morality, rule-based order. It's not for him. He is of different nature. He attacks, he would understand the force as a counter-argument. And let's forget about anything else which could be used to persuade him.
I think we have time for one, possibly two more questions. Hans, yes, right here.
Yes, hello, my name is Ala Rogers and I'm working in the field of art and culture for Global Peace Education Network. My question for you is the statistics that have been collected so far about seizure of cultural patrimony in occupied territory and in territory that has been reduced to rubble in Ukraine is greater than the Nazi seizure of art assets during World War II. It's enormous. And so just as an example, for instance, if the looting of museums in Mariupol represents the confiscation of all of the Ivazovsky paintings that were in Crimea at the time. Has a commission been established to assess the value of cultural patrimony that has been seized or destroyed by Russia as part of the valuation that you could include in your calculation of what has been lost?
Mm-hmm. Really good point. To the best of my knowledge, the price of our heritage and cultural assets was not included in the assessment. Fully, oh, I have a correction from my team that it was. Sorry, I made a mistake. I still do not understand how that happened. But if you can give an update on that, I would be really grateful. Irina is my deputy.
Kritika? The mic? Yeah.
Good question. Because the damage to our cultural heritage, it really enormous. And according to the third rapid damage at needs assessment, which was conducted by World Bank together with international organizations, as of 31st of December 2023, evaluation executed cost to Ukrainian culture due to full-scale Russian invasion, so meaning after 24th of February 2022, is estimated at $2.85 billion. And Of course, this figure is not final. Mm-hmm. It will be much bigger when we will discover, when we will liberate our territories and discover what actually happened there. But just a few comments on the most outrageous Russian attacks on Ukrainian heritage. Where are the missile strikes on the objects of cultural heritage of the great importance for humanity? So World Heritage Property, Historic Center of Odessa, National Grigoriy Skovoroda Museum, Ivankin Historical and Local History Museum, and Karazin National University. So these are objects of the importance for the humanity, not for Ukraine. So and you can imagine how, so we have daily missile attacks, and they are indiscriminate to infrastructure, to residential districts, to deliberately to cultural heritage. I do believe, and it's really, it's the number of these damages and destruction is will be much more higher. But there are international organizations who are together with Ukraine are participating in collecting the evidences, collecting the information, preserving. And by the way, the register, which was mentioned by Mr. Basha, the category of damages will include the damage caused to Ukraine culture and heritage objects. So all this information will be duly preserved. And I do hope that the next component of the compensation mechanism, claims commission and compensation fund would be duly established within some reasonable time so that to get the decisions on the amount of compensation to be paid to private individuals, to legal entities, as well as to the state. And finally, we will come to the issue that Israel Russia pays itself and fulfills its duty. It's not the right to get reparation. It's duty of Russia to make reparations according to customary international law and according to articles of responsibility of the state for international wrongful act. And either it pays or the global community finds the way how to induce Russia to pay through getting access to Russian assets.
You see, our Ministry of Culture is better than I expected. they managed to include the damages for that. But the damages starting from 2014, when Russia invaded Crimea, they are like really terrifying. And we managed to get back something, particularly exhibition which was presented at Netherlands and got stuck there. For many, many years of litigation, we were successful. We returned back that exhibition. Ancient gold was there, but still quite a lot of treasuries remained in Crimea. So, well, that is a disaster from that perspective.
I think that's where we come to an end and a closure, as we're just past 12:30 here in Washington, D.C. Thanks to everyone for coming, and thank you, Minister, for such a splendid explanation of so much detail, but also of general principles as well. We appreciate
Thanks
that.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.